Those relations made it quite impossible to develop the kind of productive capitalism that marks our own era, in which freedom for individuals to move from place to place, from task to task, from status to status, to confront each other sometimes as buyers and sometimes as sellers, sometimes as owners and sometimes as tenants, sometimes as producers and sometimes as consumers, is an absolute necessity. For example, serfdom had to be abolished in Russia in the middle of the 19th century because there was a shortage of factory labor, and serfs were prohibited by law from being sent to factories. Sometimes, in fact, serf owners illegally shipped their peasants into factories, and we know that serfs petitioned the Tsar for relief. Just as social organization was seen as an indissoluble whole, so was nature. Living and dead could be transformed one into the other, provided one knew the mystical formula. Nature could not be understood by taking it into pieces, because by doing so, one destroyed what was essential to it. Alexander Pope said, "It was like following life through creatures you dissect. You lose it in the moment you detect." One consequence was that human anatomy and the functions of various organs could not be understood, because one could not dissect them, nor could one look at each organ separately as having a separate function. Another was that herbs and roots were regarded as treatments for various parts of the body if their shape was similar to those parts. So, for example, mandrake root, which looked like a little baby or a small human, was supposed to be good for infertility. With the change in social organization that was brought about by developing industrial capitalism, a whole new view of society arose, one in which the individual was primary and independent, a kind of autonomous social atom that could move from place to place and role to role. Society is now thought to be the consequence, not the cause, of individual properties. It's individuals who together make society. Modern economics is grounded in the theory of consumer preference. Individual autonomous firms compete with each other and replace each other. Individuals have power over their own bodies and their own labor power in what we call possessive individualism. This atomized society is matched by a new view of nature, the reductionist view. Now it is believed that the whole is to be understood only by taking it into pieces, that the individual bits and pieces, the atoms, molecules, cells, genes, are the causes of the properties of the whole objects and must be separately studied if we are to understand complex nature. Darwin's theory of evolution was a theory of the differential reproductive rate of individuals. Those individuals with certain traits, certain properties that made them more efficient, that made them use the resources of the limited world better, would leave more offspring. And the consequence would be that the species as a whole would evolve toward those more efficient and those better forms. All of the phenomena of evolution could be understood at this individual causal level. All of modern biology, and indeed all of modern science, takes as its informing metaphor the clock mechanism described by René Descartes in part 5 of his Discours. Descartes, being religious, excluded the human soul from the universal clock, but that very soon came to be included as well. Modern science sees the world, both living and dead, as a large and complicated system of gears and levers. A second feature of the transformation of scientific views in the industrial era has been the clear separation between causes and effects. Things are supposed to be either one or the other. Again, in Darwin's view, organisms were acted upon by the environment. They were the passive objects, and the external world was the active subject. This alienation of the organism from its outside world means that the outside world has its own laws that are independent of the organisms, and so cannot be changed by those organisms. Organisms find the world as it is, and they must either adapt or die. Nature, love it or leave it. It's the natural analog of the old saw that you can't fight City Hall. As we'll see in a later lecture, this is an impoverished and incorrect view of the actual relationship between organisms and the world they occupy, a world which they by and large create by their own living activities. So, the ideology of modern science, and especially of modern biology, makes the properties of individuals the causal source of all the properties of larger collectivities. It prescribes a way of studying the world which is to cut it up into little bits and pieces, the bits and pieces that cause it, and to study the properties of those bits in isolation. It breaks the world up into independent, autonomous domains, the internal and the external. Causes are either internal or external, and there is no mutual dependency between them. For biology, this worldview has resulted in a particular picture of organisms and their total life activity. Living beings are seen as being determined by internal factors, the genes. Our genes, and the DNA molecules that make them up, are the modern form of the old religious doctrine of grace. Either you have it when you're born or you don't. There's nothing you can do in life to acquire it. You either are in a state of grace or you are not. In the same way, biologists claim that some of us are born with the genes that make us intelligent, that make us aggressive, that give us wonderful temperaments, that make us possible to be successful in life, and others are born with genes that destine us to be imposed on by others, to be poor, to be unhealthy. According to this view, we will only understand what we are when we know what our genes are made of. The world outside us poses certain problems which we do not create, but only experience as objects. The problems are to find a mate, to find food, to win out in competition over others, to acquire a large part of the world resources as our own. And if we have the right kinds of genes, we'll be able to solve those problems and we'll leave more offspring. So, according to this view, it's really our genes that are propagating themselves through us. We are only their instruments, their temporary vehicles, through which the genes that make us up either succeed or fail to spread through the world. In the words of Richard Dawkins, one of the leading proponents of this biological view, we are lumbering robots whose genes control us body and mind. Just as at one level, genes determine individuals, so at the next level, it's individuals that determine collectivities. If we want to understand, for example, why an ant colony has the particular division of tasks that it has, or a flock of birds flies in a particular way, we need only to look at the individual ants and the individual birds, because the behavior of the group is a consequence of the individual behaviors of the single organisms, which of course are in turn determined by their genes. For human beings, that view means that the structure of our society is seen as nothing but the result of the collection of individual behaviors. If our country goes to war, it's because we feel aggressive as individuals. If we live in a competitive, entrepreneurial society, it's because each one of us, as an individual, has a drive to be competitive and entrepreneurial. Genes make individuals, and individuals make society, and so genes make society. If one society is different from another, that's because the genes of the individuals in one society are different from the genes in another. Different races are thought to be genetically different in how aggressive or creative or musical they may be. Indeed, culture as a whole is seen as made up of little bits and pieces of cultural bric-a-brac, what some sociobiologists call culture gens. A culture is simply a sack of bits and pieces, like aesthetic preferences, mating preferences, work and leisure preferences. Dump out the sack, and culture will be displayed before you. So, the hierarchy is complete. Genes make individuals, individuals have particular preferences and behaviors, and the collection of preferences and behaviors makes a culture. And so, genes make a culture. That's why molecular biologists are urging us to spend as much money as necessary to get the sequence of all of the DNA that makes up the genes of a human being. Because they say, when we know the sequence of the molecules that make up all our genes, we will know what it is to be human. When we know what our DNA looks like, we will know why some of us are rich and some are poor, some are healthy and some are sick, some are powerful and some are weak. We'll also know why some societies are powerful and rich and others are weak and poor, why one nation, one sex, one race dominates another. Indeed, we'll know why there's such a thing as a science of biology, which is itself one of the bits and pieces of culture lying at the bottom of the sack. We've become so used to the atomistic machine view of the world that originated with Descartes that we have really forgotten that it's a metaphor, We no longer think, as Descartes did, that the world is like a clock. We think it is a clock. We cannot imagine an alternative view, unless it be one that goes back in history to a pre-scientific era. For those who are dissatisfied, and properly so, with the modern world, and dislike the artifacts of science, the pollution, the noise, the industrial world, the wars, the over-mechanized medical care that seems not to make us feel better much of the time, for people who want to go back to nature in the good old ways, the response has been to return to a description of the world as an indissoluble whole which we murder to dissect. For them, there's no use in trying to break anything down into any parts, because we lose the essence inevitably, and the best we can do is to treat the world holistically. But this so-called holistic worldview is not tenable. It's simply another form of mysticism, and it does not make it possible to manipulate the world for our own benefit. An obscurantist holism has been tried, and it's failed. Thinking good thoughts and visualizing one's tumor has not cured cancer. Eating macrobiotic diets has ruined people's health. It has not improved their nutrition. So-called holistic medicine, despite the anecdotal testimony of a few, has proved no more curative than prayer. The world is not one huge organism that regulates itself to some good end, as the believers in the Gaia hypothesis believe. There is not a shred of evidence for such a self-regulating system. 99.999% of all the species that have ever lived are already extinct, and the rate of extinction at the present is about what it was a billion years ago. In 3 billion years from now, the Earth will be burned to a cinder by an expanding sun, so life is half over. Universal balance and harmony are ideologies, pure and simple, invoked in an understandable revulsion against the soulless ideology of Adam Smith's invisible hand. While in some theoretical sense the trembling of a flower is felt on the farthest star, in practice my gardening really does not have an effect on the orbit of Neptune, because the forces of gravitation are extremely weak and they fall off very rapidly with distance. So there's clearly truth in the belief that the world can be broken up into independent parts. But that is not a universal direction for how to study all of nature. A lot of nature, as we shall see, cannot be broken up into independent parts that are to be studied in isolation, and it is pure ideology to suppose that they can. The problem is to construct a third view, one that sees the entire world neither as an indissoluble whole, nor with the equally incorrect, but presently dominant view, that at every level the world is made up of bits and pieces that can be isolated and that have properties that can be studied in isolation. Both of these ideologies, one that mirrors the pre-modern feudal social world, and the other that mirrors the modern competitive individualistic entrepreneurial world, prevent us from seeing the full richness of interaction in nature. In the end, they prevent a real understanding of nature and prevent us from solving the problems to which science is supposed to apply itself. In the lectures that follow this one, I look in some detail at particular manifestations of the modern scientific ideology and the false paths down which it has led us. I'll consider how biological determinism has been used to explain and justify inequalities within and between societies, and to claim that those inequalities can never really be changed because they are fixed in our genes. We will see how a theory of human nature has been developed, using Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, to claim that social organization is also unchangeable because it has been fixed in our genes and because it is natural. We will see how problems of health and disease have been located within the individual and within the individual's genes, so that the individual becomes a problem for society to cope with, rather than society becoming a problem for the individual to cope with. And we will see how simple economic relations, masquerading as facts of nature, can drive the entire direction of biological research and technology. While these lectures are meant, frankly, to disillusion the listener about the objectivity and the vision of transcendent truth claimed by scientists, they're not intended to be anti-scientific, or to suggest that we should give up science in favor of astrology or thinking beautiful thoughts. Rather, They're meant to acquaint the listener with the truth about science as a social activity, and to promote a reasonable skepticism about the sweeping claims that modern science makes to an understanding of human existence. But there's an important difference between skepticism and cynicism. For the former, skepticism can lead to action, and the latter, cynicism, leads only to passivity. So these lectures have a political end, too, and that is to encourage the listeners not to leave science to the experts, not to be mystified by it, but to demand a sophisticated scientific understanding in which everyone can share.
The 1990 Massey Lectures, presented by Richard C. Lewontin, continue tomorrow night on Ideas. Following the Massey Lectures, I had an opportunity to interview Professor Lewontin about their content. I began by asking him what he thought biology had missed by focusing on a reductionist approach to research.
Well, there are two primary problems that biology, at least, has failed to solve because of its entirely reductionist and mechanist viewpoint, and that is the problem of the development of the organism from the fertilized egg, and the problem of the development of what we call our nervous system, but in fact we mean our entire set of attitudes, thoughts, the problem of the central nervous system. Those two problems are related to each other. They're both developmental problems. One is a problem of the development of the physical organism in its simple physiological and anatomical aspects, and the other is the development of attitudes, views, the way we think, how we remember, how we recognize, that kind of function of our brains. Both of those problems remain almost, not quite, but almost in the same state they were 50 or 100 years ago. It's clear that the central nervous system cannot be understood, or at least has not been understood, by simple reductionist mechanical models like computers or single circuits or the firing of a particular electronic tube as they would be in an electronic circuit. And the same thing is true for development. There have been all sorts of reductionist fads in understanding how organisms develop from the fertilized egg.
And how would you like to see science progress?
I think we need to pay very much more attention to higher-level structures rather than always thinking that all of the information is contained at the lowest level. I can give you an example from ecology and evolution, which has nothing to do with the actual structure of cells. There's a great deal of talk about how individual species can continue to exist, what keeps them from going extinct, what determines how many species there are. And the standard way of studying this has been to look at each species as an entity in its evolution. You ask, how did humans evolve? How did rats evolve? How did plants evolve? But there's practically no study, there's a little bit, but practically no study of how different species co-evolve. That is to say, how the evolution of the human species was influenced by the simultaneous evolution of other species around it. How the evolution of the human species was influenced by the evolution of the environment in which the organism lives. And the evolution of the environment in which the organism lives is a consequence of the evolution of the organism because organisms make their own environment. So we need to carry on what we can call co-evolutionary studies. We need to study the simultaneous evolution of organisms in their environment, the simultaneous evolution of different organisms that are interacting, like plants and their insect pests, like plants and the animals that feed on them, and so study the evolution of those higher-level structures. That's the story of coevolution of the organism and its environment. It is left out of account entirely in classical Darwinism, and classical Darwinism has then directed all of our attention to how organisms differ one from the other in a fixed world, whereas what we should be looking at is how different kinds of organisms make different worlds. And that's experimentally attackable. That's not simply a theoretical issue. I can go into my laboratory, into the field tomorrow, and by setting up particular kinds of external worlds, a particular amount of moisture and other organisms and temperature and food and so on, I can ask the question, how do genetically different organisms alter that world in different ways, and how does the alteration that they make in that external environment come back on them to affect their own future evolution. Those are experimentally attackable, but nobody does it.
We often see it, though, don't we? The Galapagos, for example, seem to have been shot down in places by goats. Goats are, I guess, desert animals originally, and they sure try to turn everything into a desert, don't they?
Well, I don't know if they try, but they certainly succeed. And we see every day around us, I mean, it's our everyday experience, that organisms are making the world for themselves. Squirrels bury nuts, birds make nests, people make houses. Every organism is in the process of reconstructing the world to suit its demands. And if different organisms have slightly different demands, they reconstruct the world in slightly different ways, and we need to know a great deal more about that.
You're implying that it's virtually impossible for science to be objective in some magisterial, uniform, old-fashioned Newtonian way. Do you think we should forget about notions of objectivity altogether and try and develop a new methodology of science that would incorporate human experience? How can we operate with science not being objective? How can we do to make it fair, if not objective?
That's a really good question, because to say that science is not objective is not the same thing as saying that any old thing counts as science. Science has canons. That is to say, we have a certain logic, for example, which demands that 1 + 1 make 2, and any scientist who says, well, I'm going to tell you about the world, and the basis of my telling you about the world is my understanding that 1 + 1 makes 3, is something we want to reject. In the same sense, anyone who says that the moon is made of green cheese is simply saying that something that isn't true. And just because it seems to them that the moon might be made of green cheese, that doesn't make it science either. So although science is not objective in a social sense, and one we can talk about, there are certain rules about a material world and the way you deal with that material world. There are certain rules of logic which work for us when we manipulate the material world. And logic is, after all, only made up by people, but these rules turn out to work for us. That science must follow. And in that sense, we must demand that science be so-called objective. It's got to follow the rules of logic which make the world work for us. It's got to accept certain material relations in the world which are the same under all political systems and under all ideologies. So we can't simply call for a kind of fuzzy-minded view of the world.
Objectivity.
But what we can do,
you know, we talk a great deal about can broadcasters be objective? And our answer is that what we try to do is share the process as much as possible. How did we do it? Where did we get the information from? What did we do next? And things of that kind. Is that a method which works in science?
Well, let me speak first about broadcasters and say if broadcasters really want to be objective about science, they need to tell people more than they're telling them. They need to tell them not only what the methods of science are and what the physical or commercial product of science is, they need to tell them the objective facts about where that science came from. They ought to tell their listeners or their readers why scientists are really doing this particular bit of science, who's paying for it, who will benefit from it, where the ideas come from, and so on. And when they do that, that's part of their task as objective observers of the social scene. For scientists, part of their objectivity has got to be the self-consciousness of where their ideas come from, of who's paying for it, of who will benefit. For example, in the case of hybrid corn, if scientists would stop saying that hybrid corn is the way to increase corn yields and recognize that hybrid corn is a very important commercial product from which people make a lot of money, and that the reason we've developed hybrid corn is because there's been a lot of pressure on science to produce this method of making money, that would be part of scientific objectivity. Scientific objectivity does not include only the objectivity of test tubes and computers. It includes objectivity in the sense of a broader view of science as a social product.
You encourage our listeners not to leave science to the experts. Given what you see as the ideological nature of science, what can we do to ensure that science is at least socially responsible?
Well, I hate to give a flip answer to that question, but I think ultimately the only answer is to make a social revolution. The problem is one of power. To make science socially responsible means to deprive a small group who are in the know of the power they have to decide in which direction science will go and what you and I, or perhaps not you and I because we're both PhDs, but what other people will learn about science. The real issue is that a social institution can only respond to general social demands when there is some power on the part of people in general to control what those institutions do.
Science is already socially responsible to some people, namely to an elite of some kind, a power elite. And the problem is not science's responsibility, but exactly to whom should science be reporting?
That's precisely the point, Lister. You've put it exactly right. Of course science is socially responsible because, after all, somebody's paying the bills. Somebody is creating the university. Somebody's sitting on the boards of trustees. Somebody's sitting there in the National Research Council of Canada giving away money. And scientists are responsible to those people. So, of course, I assume the question you were really asking me was, how do we make science answer, because responsible means literally answerable to, how do we stop making science answerable to those people and make it answerable to everybody else? And my answer to that is only when the mass of people can succeed in acquiring real political power. The answer for science is not different from the answer for any other aspect of society. You cannot have a science that is responsible to the majority, the vast majority of people, if you don't have other social institutions that are responsible, answerable. And it has simply turned out that the two models that have existed in the world up to the present time, namely the so-called democratic model in which people go to the polling booth and they vote for people, that's one model. The other is in which you have a leading party which is supposed to stand for the interests of everybody else and do what's good for them. Neither of those models has succeeded so far in providing to most people the power to control social institutions for their own welfare.
That was Dr. Richard Lewontin speaking on biology as ideology. This is the first of a series of lectures on that subject he gave in 1990. We'll be playing more of them on the program.
After I was born, I went home to watch my TV. Everyone was nice and the smiles were so sparkly. I watched what made them happy and I watched what made them cry. I learned about toys and candy my mommy should buy.
Since October, I've been reading weekly installments from a book, Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives, by Jeff Schmidt. Jeff Schmidt, who was trained as a physicist, has been making the case in the book that the system of professional training and education that produces intellectuals is not designed to further creativity and innovation, but to select candidates who will maintain an ideological discipline and use their intelligence, skills, and creativity only within the narrow confines of what serves the existing power structures in society. We've now reached the final part of the book, which is devoted to resisting the indoctrination that is a part of professional training in order to allow people to move through the system, obtain the advanced degree, yet maintain their values, idealism, and originality. This is Chapter 15, titled How to Survive Professional Training with Your Values Intact. On the 30th of December, 1981, the United States Army issued a survival manual for graduate school, but no one recognized Field Manual number 21-78 as anything of the kind. True, the 108-page how-to book wasn't written for graduate students. It was written to show soldiers how to resist brainwashing and exploitation as prisoners of war. But in light of what we saw in the previous chapter, students in graduate or professional school should be able to put such resistance techniques to good use. In fact, in a crucial way, the military manual is superior to civilian advice books written specifically for students in graduate or professional school. The problem with the civilian guidebooks is that they simply help you conform successfully to the demands of the training institution. You get your credential, but lose your identity in the process. The Army manual, on the other hand, shows you how to survive the training program and keep control over your identity. The military calls this honorable survival, and in this chapter, I will quote extensively from the Army manual about how to achieve it. Mere survival is, of course, a precondition for honorable survival, but it doesn't get you even halfway there. In graduate school, as in the POW camp, the toughest struggle is not over whether you will survive the process, but over what sort of person you will be when you get out. Thus, if you want to become a professional to be in a better position to pursue your own vision, then the most difficult step is making sure you will still have your own vision after going through professional training. Here I am assuming that you are not a fan of the status quo, with its tired old ways that make work boring, its bureaucracy that takes the fun out of innovation, its decision-making that defies common sense, and its just-fine-thank-you-old-guard that sets the cautious tone. Rather, I assume your vision is forward-looking, and that one reason you want to become a professional is to have some power to further it. But after professional training, will your attitude still be critical and independent, or will it be uncritical and subordinate? If you don't think attitude is the big issue in professional training, take a look at the civilian guidebooks. In his popular Graduate School Survival Guide, Robert L. Peters makes rare use of italics to warn that if you want to get what you came for, then you had better, quote, make it a firm rule never to say bad things within the university community. Every conscientious guidebook author who accepts the training system for what it is comes to this same conclusion, which speaks volumes about the true nature of graduate education. This requirement of strict attitude control is reminiscent of cult indoctrination, in which the rules for survival are the same, only more explicit. Here's how a former member of The Way International described it. All the time you have to think positive and speak positive. You can't have negative emotions. You battle any negative feelings. You become out of touch with your feelings. You don't go by your feelings. You go by the word of God. The people who run the group are the spiritual leaders. So they can say, when you write your diary, don't write anything negative, and you just do it. You write the positives. You write the word of God. They can have your TWIG coordinator, local group leader, read your diary and make sure you didn't write anything negative. They can do that when you're in the WAY Corps, the leadership training program that I was in. The WAY Corps is like 100% commitment. The people in it are considered the top of the line, the cream of the crop. Close quote. With or without guidebooks, a lot of students make it through professional training, but give up the heart of their identity in the process. I'll call these students Group 1. Many others don't finish the program, but do hold on to who they are, Group 2. Only a fortunate few get through graduate or professional school with their attitude and values intact, Group 3. How do they do it? Students in all three groups have run-ins with the faculty. Even students who follow a mainstream guidebook and make a conscious effort to adopt the favored attitude and values eventually find themselves targeted for a hard time because they inevitably underestimate just how thoroughly they are expected to conform. Those headed for the first two groups defend their identity unconsciously, never recognizing that their attitude and values are at the root of their conflicts with the faculty. Bewildered by the trouble they are having, and therefore unsure about their own culpability, these students don't feel they have the right to demand that the faculty accept them for who they are. So they either back away from who they are and end up in the first group, or back away from demanding acceptance and end up in the second group. The few individuals who make it into the third group have one thing in common. At some point during their professional training, they stand up for their values, fight it out with the faculty, and win the right to be different. Attitudes and values atrophy if not acted upon, and so students make it into the third group only if they find a survivable way to take a stand for their beliefs. Because of the disparity in power between students and faculty, the student can't go it alone. Hence, the formula for surviving professional training with your attitude and values intact is, in a word, organize. Work with others and fight for your values consciously. You are going to have conflict in any case, so you might as well do it right and retain control of your identity. The same word, organize, summarizes the military's advice. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. I'm reading Chapter 15, Surviving Professional Training with Your Values Intact, going on to the next subsection, Prisoner of War Resistance. Simple reasoning led me to the Army Field Manual. I figured that because professional training shares so many essential features with brainwashing, somewhere there must already exist a uniquely insightful survival manual for professional training in the form of instructional material on resisting brainwashing. All I needed to do was find it. I expected the military to be knowledgeable in mind control, running as it does a massive indoctrination program of its own, in which it turns fresh recruits into people with a military mentality. In particular, I expected the military to know effective resistance techniques that captured troops can use if they don't want to be re-indoctrinated. So I called the Pentagon, and sure enough, soon I was talking to Colonel John Chapman, head of the Joint Services Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape Agency, SEER. The colonel explained that his 100-person organization, which is headquartered in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, debriefs returned captives, produces survival, evasion, resistance, and escape training material, and oversees SEER training in the various branches of the military. He offered the assistance of the head SEER psychologist, Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Jessen, Ph.D. I keep him out at Fairchild because we do some training out there, said Chapman, referring to the Air Force base in Washington State. He asked Jessen to put together a bibliography on resistance. When Chapman faxed me the result, he explained that we build our training around these references and some of our own references. The bibliography contained publications that were clearly, though inadvertently, relevant to professional training, and that in turn led me to other such documents. Two major themes ran throughout these publications: commitment to ideals and solidarity among the targets of indoctrination. The Army Field Manual is the best of the documents, as it synthesizes everything into one practical guide, titled Prisoner of War Resistance. Its contents come from debriefings of former prisoners of war, as well as from researchers who studied the subject. After the Army issued the manual, It tightened its restriction on revealing its resistance techniques. And so the second edition of Field Manual 21-78, issued in 1989, is a classified document. We don't want the people who potentially will hold our individuals as captives to know what we teach them to do to deal with it, Jessen told me. But the first edition of the manual had already let the cat out of the bag. This chapter presents some excerpts from it. If you're a student in graduate or professional school, you should have no trouble seeing how the military's hard-won lessons apply to the situation in your particular program. In fact, you will likely find it hard not to make the connections. But you don't have to be a student for this subordination resistance manual to strike a resonant chord in your life, because its insights will apply to all social hierarchies. If you were an employee, for example, application to your workplace will leap out at you. I have divided the excerpts into 5 overlapping subtopics. Knowing what you're up against, in the military's words, some basic captor approaches, preparing to take action, resistance training, working with others, make a team effort, resisting subordination, resist, and dealing with weak links, willing collaboration. Keep in mind that every subordinating institution has its own way of bringing about the oppressive conditions discussed in the manual. In a professional training program, for example, time pressure, insecurity, stress, and an overly demanding schedule can lead to lack of sleep, junk food diets, and social isolation. In a POW camp, by contrast, an indoctrinator might simply arrange for sleep deprivation, poor nutrition, and isolation. The mechanism is different, but the result is similar. Because of the essential similarity of hierarchical institutions, tailoring the POW resistance manual to your school or workplace requires nothing more than a few simple word substitutions. A frightening fact when you think about it. Graduate students, for example, might substitute graduate or professional school for PW camp, student for soldier, PW or man, institution or faculty for the captors, expel for kill, upheld values for honor, graduate with your values intact for escape or honorable survival, job for big ticket item, being obsequious for bowing, institutions for nations, and so on. Use your imagination and have fun. Prisoner of War Resistance. The battle in the prisoner of war camp is for the mind. And this is an excerpt from the manual. As a PW, your own most powerful and valuable weapon is resistance. It is the only honorable course of action. Resistance can mean the difference between respectful or disrespectful treatment, walking out of a PW camp or coming feet first, returning with honor or returning in disgrace, failure or success as escape, pride or shame, looked up to or down by the other PWs, family, and friends. Resistance is the ability to mold the PW environment to your needs and objectives. Work and cooperate with the other PWs. Every man for himself does not work in a PW camp. The only way to defeat your captor is to unite and organize. Knowing what you're up against. There are only a few ways to get people to adopt the right attitude within a set amount of time, say during the course of a professional training program or during a probationary period on a job. The methods are simple, and people who are given power over others, say the power to deny degrees or fire employees, quickly rediscover them on their own. Students and employees who are familiar with these attitude-altering techniques and setups, some of which are mentioned below, will be better able to hold on to their values. And again from the field manual, some basic captor approaches. As a PW, you must meet the challenges of loneliness, fatigue, fear, anger, monotony, isolation, a hostile, enemy-imposed environment. The psychological effect of captivity may be greater and last longer than the physical effects. Your captor will work to try to break you, to try to weaken your belief in yourself and your will to keep your identity and maintain your lifetime code of ethics, decency, and standards of behavior. Generally, the enemy does not want to kill PWs for one major reason. Among others, a dead PW cannot be exploited. Enemy can bring about disordered mental function. No amount of willpower can prevent it. Your captors don't have to use physical brutality. Extreme fatigue, lack of sleep, and pain, for example, can cause it. Complex mental functions are lost first. The ability to carry out highly creative activities. There is less concern about morality and right and wrong. Generally, socially oriented behavior falls away. Your captor will try to disgrace you in the eyes of others, especially your fellow prisoners. Or he will try to make you feel disgraced and ashamed of yourself. What's the use of resisting technique? Using this approach, your captor tries to make you quit resisting by saying, for example, "What's the use of holding out? Why suffer? You are at our mercy. We can do what we want with you." Or he may put it to you this way, "You're not going anywhere. You'll be here a long time. Why not make it easier on yourself? Cooperate, and we'll see that your stay here is pleasant." Method shows power over life and death. How they do it. Captor show of power, i.e., executions, torture, starvation, favors, good clothing, medical care, food, and shelter, or deprived of food, medical care, etc. Complete control of physical conditions in a camp. Uncertainty of not knowing when or why treatment will change is a threat. What it does, makes PW know who is boss, who runs the show, who pulls the strings. Breeds extreme caution among PWs. Evidence of power over life hits home. Method. Deliberately caused physical deterioration. How they do it. Extremely long interrogation and forced writing sessions, making the PW overly tired. Insufficient, poorly prepared, unpalatable, non-nourishing, monotonous, strange food. What it does, drastic lowering of PW's resistance level to interrogation, indoctrination, exploitation. Method, now and then kind of treatment. How they do it, favors. Now and then, better living conditions, food, clothes, shelter, surroundings. Easy interrogation. Teases with a small desirable item, letting the PW know that he can get a big ticket item for complying with captor wishes. Promises other rewards for compliance. What it does. Tries to build a he's not such a bad guy attitude in the PW. Makes resistance seem like a bad time and undesirable compared with the luxuries the captor can give. The indoctrination process may be gradual. They know that a person who convinces himself that something is right or wrong, good or bad, is a better and more lasting convert than one who has ideas stuffed down his throat. Your captor wants to make you, the captured soldier, both the propagandist and the object of propaganda. and I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, reading Surviving Professional Training with Your Values Intact, the next subsection on resisting indoctrination, preparing to take action. People in subordinate positions naturally ready themselves to deal with those above them in the hierarchy, but they don't always admit to themselves that that is what they are doing. Students and employees, for example, take a keen interest in any information they can get about the professors or managers they must face. They eagerly share their information and analysis of it. They learn from individuals who have more experience dealing with the authorities and teach those who have less. Stories of past struggles at their schools or workplaces at other schools or workplaces are of special interest. The excerpts below assume that serious, conscious study of your situation is wise. From the Field Manual. Resistance Training. Training should make the soldier self-reliant and a team worker. He must understand that both are needed for success on any battlefield. Proper training impresses personnel with the values of and the need for group loyalty, unity, and action, while training them to understand the full extent of their own abilities. Training should teach him not only to reach deeply within himself for courage and initiative in times of stress, but to reach out to his fellow soldiers to help them to assure that he lives and succeeds through their survival and success. Training should give each soldier confidence in his ability to deny the enemy information and resist interrogation, exploitation, and indoctrination. Training should emphasize the psychological aspects of interrogation, indoctrination, exploitation, and isolation, so that the trainee, if captured, will know what to expect and can better resist the enemy. Life, sanity, reputation may depend upon the quality and thoroughness of this training. To resist successfully, a PW must know his captors. Culture, customs, social standards, economic way of life, political structure, system of justice, relationships with other nations, overall strategy regarding the handling of PWs, long-range plans, general methods for gaining objectives, i.e. torture, mental stress, the carrot-and-stick approach, etc. With this information, a PW can plan suitable resistance. Be familiar with the captor's reasons for and methods of attempting to indoctrinate prisoners politically. Be familiar with the methods of resisting such indoctrination. Working with others. Organizing is almost magically empowering, but it is very difficult, even under the best circumstances. The difficulties remain essentially the same even when the individuals to be organized are subordinate in very different ways. Janitors in an office building, doctors employed by an HMO, students in graduate school, minorities in a racist institution, any subordinate group can benefit from solidarity and can learn valuable principles and tactics from the struggles of other groups. The politics of power are universal. And from the Army Manual again, make a team effort. Prisoners of war must present a united front to the enemy. While individually they may be weak, as a unified group they are strong. Help each other and make sacrifices whenever necessary. A PW environment puts a man and his will to the test. Keep your differences to yourself. Work them out quietly. If you don't, your captor will try to exploit them. Do not bring upon a fellow prisoner that which you would not have them bring upon you. Place unity above self. Unified PWs represent a serious threat to the enemy, to their plans and achievement of objectives. Live and work as a member of a cooperating, cohesive unit. used U.S. names and ranks in addressing each other, not names or ranks conferred by the enemy. When there are several or many PWs, communications and organization are possible and necessary. To resist the enemy effectively and to give each PW a better chance to escape, it is important to set up a PW organization. Learn the names and locations of other PWs. Learn the status and state of well-being of each. Learn their relationship with the enemy, collaborators, informers, traitors, neutral, and non-committed, or okay all the way. Experience has proven that some individuals are not blessed with sufficient levels of education, training, faith, character, or pride on which to draw for defenses. These people cannot be discarded or left to flounder by themselves. They must be helped. They must be brought into and made an integral part of the PW unit. They must be given responsibilities within their capabilities, perhaps a little beyond their capabilities, and helped to achieve them by encouraging and actively assisting if necessary to bring them into the mainstream of the PW activities and unit is a major test of leadership and unity. At some time or other, a feeling of remoteness hits every PW. Away from family and friends, he gets that feeling of being away from it all. It is a dangerous feeling. It can bring about a complete separation from reality. It may make the PW feel he has been forgotten and abandoned. And his captor makes every effort to make the PW believe it. He tries to instill a feeling of being alone and abandoned, but as a PW, you are a part of something, some group, some organization. You are not remote from your responsibilities toward the outfit. They are real. Carry them out. Others will work with you. As long as that happens, you are in the real world. You will stay in touch with reality. You may, regardless of rank or grade, become a key figure among other PWs. Look to for leadership guidance and advice. The PW camp is a place where each soldier proves his courage. And that was an excerpt from a U.S. Army field manual for prisoners of war. I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. In Chapter 15, Surviving Professional Training. Disciplined Minds was published in 2000 by Roman and Littlefield, and you can find out more about the book and its author, Jeff Schmidt, at disciplinedminds.com. The music featured in today's program was written and performed by Dana Lyons. For more music by Dana, go to www.cowswithguns.com. And you can contact us at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme song, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. And last but not least, thank you, David.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always